Do you know what it's like to be faced with a tight corner situation where you've got to do something, but you've a limited range of choices to work with? None of which seems quite totally right. It can be quite a troubling thing to have to deal with. Well, if that rings any bells with you, welcome to the Book of Esther, Chapter 2, and to Mordecai and Esther's Ugly World. If it doesn't, please do be grateful for the fact, but listen up, because this is a feature of faithful life in a fallen world. And you never know when such a dilemma might be coming your way. So here's the situation. Mordecai has had to take on looking after his relative Esther, who's an orphan and a young and vulnerable young woman, in a totally male-dominated, female-exploitative situation. What's more, Mordecai and Esther are Jewish, the people of God's Old Testament covenant. But they've been stuck in exile for ages, their God having turned a bit silent on them as the result of centuries of open sin, and now the despot who rules over them is getting very much worse. They have limited choices, each of which would compromise them in some way, and they just need God to step in and sort this out. And for the moment, he seems to be tantalizingly distant. See, there is no perfect way through the challenges about to be dealt to them. Does that sound familiar? But there's something technical here we really need to notice. The Hebrew is full of the passive tense here in this chapter, as these people have things done to them that they wouldn't choose. And their choices in the situation are thoroughly limited and none of them ideal. It happens to God's people everywhere, right up until this day. A horror story is about to unfold. First of all, in verses 1 to 4 of chapter 2 of Esther, Xerxes, the king, goes wife hunting. Now, a bit of a time steer here on this. Vashti refused to come to the king in the third year of Xerxes' reign. That's the previous queen, Queen Vashti. She refused to come to the king in the third year of his reign. That's 483 BC. And Esther gets made queen in the seventh year of his reign, 479 BC. And during the intervening years, Xerxes was away fighting a disastrous war in Greece. He suffered a humiliating defeat, he depleted the treasuries of the Persian Empire, he discredited himself in the eyes of his subjects. It left him in not a terribly good mood. And shortly afterwards, Esther was chosen to be his wife. And what we're told here in Esther chapter 2 verse 1 is that later, when King Xerxes' fury had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she'd done, and what he'd decreed about her. In the Hebrew here, there may be a tinge of regret expressed in the king's remembrance of Vashti. He's regretful. There's perhaps a hint that he wished for her presence once again with him. Although that was not feasible from a practical standpoint, she'd been banished by the law of the Persians and Medes, and there was no revoking such a matter in Persia. Well, anyway, the suggestions from the king's attendants concerning a replacement for Vashti seemed to be an effort to overcome the king's nostalgia for his previous wife, that he'd banished. Now, you can just imagine it was to the royal official's advantage to seek the betterment of the king's outlook. Those around him the most were probably the most likely to suffer the effects of his bad mood. The Greek historian Herodotus says that his life after his military defeats, or his life in this period, Xerxes' life, was a life of sensual overindulgence. He's a bit of a haunted guy. He was dallying in due course with the wives of some of his officers, and that led to the anger that resulted in his assassination in his bedroom in 465 BC. This all figures because the way Xerxes went about chasing his new queen, there was something wrong about it. It wasn't the way such a thing was normally done in Persia. The queen was normally chosen, as Darius had chosen before, from the noble families of Persia. Often they came from the families of the king's seven closest advisers, who we met in chapter 1. Some suggest that perhaps one of Memucan's motives, one of those guys' motives, in having Vashti banished, might have been the hope that someone from his family might have been chosen in place of Vashti. So, in chapter 2, verses 1 to 11, the word of the king got out through the land, and many young girls were brought into the harem at Xerxes' court. Now you can see that as a feminist issue, if you wish to do so. Certainly you can, because young women are being brought to the king for him to try them out to see if they give him sexual pleasure, all without their voluntary consent. That is a feminist issue, but it's a human rights issue too. It's much more, because whilst all these girls were being taken in this way, Herodotus reports that 500 young boys were gathered each year by the Persian ruler to be castrated and serve as eunuchs in the Persian court. Essentially, you see, there may be a feminist issue here, but there's more than a feminist issue here. This is about how power was used in the Persian court against people who, this is crucial, were in no position to resist it. As Karen Jobes writes in her commentary, everyone, whether male or female, was at the disposal of the king's personal whims. So God's people are living in quite dangerous, quite compromised, and quite compromising times, with very little say in their own life. And the likelihood that personal self-determination could be wrenched away from anyone at any time. Can you imagine that? You should imagine it. You see, it's a narrative, isn't it? We're supposed to use our imaginations when we read stories to try to understand what it must have been like for the people in the story. Because doing that, by using our imagination to try to understand and feel it, is going to teach us something. That was the experience of life for God's people living under King Xerxes' rule in the Persian Empire. Their self-determination, their choices were taken from them, and they were at the mercy of the king's whim. And it is at this point, then, we get introduced to Esther and her relative Mordecai. And we can see straight away that this experience of life in exile in Persia has knocked them about a bit. We immediately start picking up hints that they compromised with the pagan culture around them as a survival tool in this terrible place. But we're going to also learn to appreciate the limits on their choices. And in due course, we'll see how God can deal with the consequences of the compromise born of limited choices that was set before his people. So, Mordecai's orphan niece gets taken in with all these women, shipped into the harem for Xerxes' pleasure. We read about that in verses 5 to 9 of chapter 2. Now there was in the citadel of Susa a Jew of the tribe of Benjamin named Mordecai, son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, who had been carried into exile from Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, among those taken captive with Jehoiakim, king of Judah. Mordecai had a cousin named Hadassah, whom he had brought up because she'd neither father nor mother. And this young woman, who was also known as Esther, had a lovely figure and was beautiful. Mordecai had taken her as his own daughter and when her father and her mother died. And when the king's order and edict had been proclaimed, many young women were brought to the citadel of Susa and put under the care of Hegai. Esther was also taken to the king's palace and entrusted to Hegai, who had charge of the harem. She pleased him and won his favour. Immediately he provided her with her beauty treatments and special food. He assigned her to 7 female attendants selected from the king's palace and moved her and her attendants into the best place in the harem. It would be hard to imagine we were not supposed to be shocked by all of this. Possibly hurt by it, because it's very possible some sort of abuse raises painful memories in many of God's people to this day. Now, Mordecai has a name that sounds like he's being described as a worshipper of Marduk, the male deity of the Babylonians. That jars a bit because we've just been told about his Jewish ancestry. He's a Benjamite, descendant of Kish. The father of King Saul was Kish. Interestingly, a tablet discovered in 1904 at Persepolis contains the name Mordecai's name, as a Persian official in the early years of King Xerxes' reign. And the description of Mordecai in this book as a man who sat in the gate, that's an expression that denotes that Mordecai was some sort of imperial official. Well, it's a potentially interesting link with that tablet discovered in 1904 in Persepolis, but we can't go further than that. Esther is introduced to us as Mordecai's cousin, who's been brought up by him because she was an orphan. That's quite a picture of vulnerability there, don't you think? But at the very start, we're told nothing about Esther herself except for her beauty. Just like Vashti, she was a beauty. Esther also has a name that she owes to the experience of exile. Her name is Hadassah, and it looks as if Esther was a name given to Hadassah to accommodate to a vulnerable situation as a member of God's people in the Persian Empire, Esther being a Hebrew transliteration for Ishtar, the Babylonian goddess of love and war. Well, that fits well with Esther's story. She is beautiful, and in just one night pleases the king more than all the other virgins taken to see if they could please the king. Interesting, isn't it? Because the outcome of this story suggests strongly that Marduk and Ishtar, the Persian deities, are subservient to the purposes of the unnamed god of the Hebrews. Well, the author mentions both names, both identities. Esther is a woman with two conflicting identities going on. Two names from very different backgrounds. And that's an issue that's going to be brought into sharp conflict later in the story. So that's what we know and what we're supposed to take with us as we imagine ourselves into the account that unfolds here now with Esther. This vulnerable, conflicted, to some extent, as we'll see, spiritually compromised young Jewish believer in hiding because she's not telling anybody of her spiritual and ethnic identity. Okay, well, this Esther, in verse 8, she gets taken. The language is glaringly expressing her vulnerability by its use of the passive here. Taken into the violent, unstable pagan king's harem. Yeah, you're supposed to let your imagination there run again as you try to picture what that would be like for her to be taken in there like that. The Jews in verse 6 had been carried into exile. Esther was taken, verse 8, into the harem. Regardless of how she felt about it, Esther was at the mercy of this ruthless pain of a king, just as all her people were too. They're being swept along, you see, by circumstances way beyond their control. And they were doing just what they needed to do to get by, just that. That's all they could think to do. And that's why Mordecai, verse 10, instructs Esther to conceal her nationality and family background, her origins, her ethnicity, and her faith. Now, that is inevitably going to mean compromising any loyalty to God's word, his law, that she may still have openly had. She's now in the Persian king's harem. She's not going to be going to synagogue, is she? Opposition to God and his people was evidently on the prowl in this environment, and there she was, taken into the harem of the crazy king of Persia. But very touchingly, Mordecai still found a way to check up on her daily, indicating the concern that was warranted, for her welfare in this compromised and compromising situation. You see, she had limited choices. What could she do, actually do? Well, the story moves on in verses 10 to 14 to describe some of Esther's experience in the harem. She's taken. She wakes up the next morning in that harem. All these young virgins around her will be used by the king, probably just the ones then tossed aside, banished from his presence to waste the rest of their lives, fruitlessly secluded in that harem. Esther's chances in there must look pretty slim, not a great place to be. And yet, looky here. Esther also was taken to the king's palace, verse 8, and entrusted to Haggai, who had charge of the harem. She pleased him, won his favour, and immediately he provided her with all sorts of benefits, put in the best place in the harem. So Esther in that harem is living with an unusual indication of the favour of the God who is silent, who is nonetheless there with her. See, this book is already going about its business of showing how, against all the odds, the fate of God's people living vulnerably within a hostile world can be reversed. And yet all this is going on while Esther lived in this threatening situation, awaiting her fate, possibly her doom, under such objectifying, demeaning and threatening conditions as these. Verse 12. Before a young woman's turn came to go in to King Xerxes, she had to complete 12 months of beauty treatments prescribed for the women, 6 months with oil of myrrh, 6 with perfumes and cosmetics. And this is how she would go to the king. Anything she wanted was given her to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. And in the evening she would go there, and in the morning return to another part of the harem to the care of Shashgaz, different guy, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the concubines. She would not return to the king unless he was pleased with her and summoned her by name. Even so, against all odds, in some mysterious way, the events of human history work to fulfill the promises the covenant God made to his people at Sinai. Even though those people's compliance with his covenant is far from perfect. And it's happening through this strange experience of this vulnerable young woman. See, this is the God who in his righteous wrath remembers mercy. And that same God is with Esther, even in the terrible situation she is thrown into on this crazy Persian king's testbed. Verses 15 to 16, Esther on the testbed. Verse 15. When the turn came for Esther, the young woman Mordecai had adopted, the daughter of his uncle Abihail, to go to the king, she asked for nothing other than what Haggai, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the harem, suggested. And Esther won the favour of everyone who saw her. She was taken to King Xerxes in the royal residence in the 10th month, the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. Seems significant, we're being told at some length, that Esther simply took what she was told to, did nothing to try to get the queen's position. She isn't ambitious, she is seeking this situation, simply going along with what she cannot avoid. And who can accurately imagine what that experience would have been like for Esther? So horribly spiritually compromised, as a closet member of God's covenant people, keeping it quiet. With a very strong prospect of being just another rejected but imprisoned woman wasting her life away in Xerxes' harem for the rest of her life. How far should God's people go to conceal their beliefs in a society that is hostile to their convictions? I mean, Daniel and the lads didn't conceal their convictions, and it was all very threatening. Now, God stepped in to rescue them, astonishing miraculously. But he didn't for Stephen, martyred so soon after the great victory day of that first Pentecost of the church. And Esther went on and lied, and actually, subsequent to her being spiritually compromised in the way that she was, proved to be the deliverer under God of her people and of God's plans and purposes for them. Mordecai and Esther assimilated themselves enough to Persian culture to be able to conceal their faith. But Esther's decision to come out of that closet and finally identify herself with God's people at risk of her own life later in the story shows where her heart and her allegiance actually, ultimately, lay. It's hard to call this either way. But what this does is it becomes a powerful encouragement to us who go through life trying to deal with situations where we want to do the right thing, to walk God's path through complicated and confusing experiences in life, where we certainly don't feel we're on top of the right path to take, nor in control of our choices or opportunity to live out our convictions. And yet, in these two people at the heart of this story of the Book of Esther, whether they always knew what the right course of action was, whether or not they actually got the decisions right, and the book doesn't draw any conclusion about that. Even whether or not they had the best of motives, God was working through their clouded vision, their imperfect actions, and their questionable decisions. God was working to fulfill his perfect purposes. Now, don't misunderstand what I'm doing here. This is not in the least to excuse having a sinful, unbelieving heart that turns away from the living God. That's not excusable. I'm suggesting that's not what we're dealing with here in this book. It is to say that in spite of our cold hearts and our unwise hearts and minds, our gracious God still works out, through our imperfect decisions and actions, his perfect purposes for his glory. Now, there's a great danger in not recognizing this. It's the danger of pretending to be other than this, to pretend that we are better than this. See, even the godliest people in the Bible were flawed, often confused, sometimes even downright disobedient, and we are no different. We want to be, but we're not. And there are many times when we have to conclude they wanted to be, those other godly people in the Bible, but they weren't different either. Karen Jobes, again in her commentary, which is great, she comments, "Yet our gracious God omnipotently works his perfect plans through them," through these imperfect people. "His perfect plans through them, through us, and most surprisingly, even through powerful political structures that sometimes operate in evil ways." Did you get that? Even through powerful political structures that sometimes operate in evil ways. I dare to suggest it might sometimes do us good to remind ourselves of this when we're watching the news. God can work through powerful political structures that sometimes operate in evil ways. Now, what God is doing is nowhere near apparent in this story. It's hard to know what Esther or Mordecai could possibly have made of what must for them have been the inscrutable plan of God that was being worked out in what happened next in the king's bedchamber. But what happens next is so remarkable, if not bizarre, that we're left thinking God must surely have been active in what was taking place. And yet, the outcome of Xerxes' beauty contest with benefits? It's certainly not what any one of us would have chosen, because in verses 17 to 18, next we read, finally in this episode, Esther finds favour and is honoured. This King Xerxes, you know, he really is a man who's mad, bad and dangerous to know. Now, obviously that description was first used by Lady Caroline Lamb about her lover Lord Byron. But while Byron had intent, he had very little wealth, power or authority to do you harm with. Xerxes was a very different kettle of fish. He had the power and he had this terribly wicked inclination. What you want to avoid when you're living in a godless, violent situation like the one we're being shown here is to come to the notice of the despot at all. Best thing is to keep your head down. There's a Japanese proverb that says, it is the nail that sticks out that gets hammered down. Well, that idea takes on a far greater poignancy in a place like the Persian Empire under the reign of King Xerxes. And here's Esther, who'd be far safer not coming to the notice of the king, far less pleasing him in his bedchamber and being made the successor of the deposed Queen Vashti. And yet, the God who is pretty silent in this book, but nevertheless very much at work, brings this highly unlikely event to pass. Verse 17, the king was attracted to Esther more than to any of the other women, and she won his favour and approval more than any of the other virgins. So he set a royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. And the king gave a great banquet, Esther's banquet, for all his nobles and officials. He proclaimed a holiday throughout the provinces and distributed gifts with royal liberality. And you might think, oh great, but actually Esther's neck is now very firmly on the block. And she's both compromised spiritually by her relationship with the king and dependent on a changeable, drunken, lecherous personality for every aspect of her situation in life. It looks as if her range of choices may actually have decreased, not increased. Let's bring this story so far to a conclusion. This story raises the question, how little choice and how compromised out of the ideal can you become as a believer and God has still got it all under control? There's a very practical challenge for us as we live as believers in the modern world. Now, you see, we know the end of this story with Esther. We know God is going to use this imperfect situation and the alarming outcome of this lack of viable-looking choices to actually achieve the fulfillment of his plan and purposes and the rescue of his people through this thing that's happening with Esther. But at this point in the situation, it's looking pretty dreadful. Now, at this point, let us be totally clear. This is no excuse for taking the seriousness of sin lightly, not at all. The issue here is that the people of God are not always given excellent choices. We know from what follows in this story that Esther is prepared to put her life on the line in the service of God and his people. There's no doubt about that. And we know she's prepared to do that in exile when God's presence is not comfortably felt very much and his voice isn't heard through the prophets. And we know about all those passive voice verbs in this chapter which show that so much of this is being done to Esther and Mordecai and not by them as if they had any choice. But here's these two people, God's people, getting tossed on the tide in this section of their lives. And yet, we know the end of the story. God, though silent, is still in control. As these two people make the best of the limited range of options available to them and are coerced into compromise that they can find no way to avoid. It's called, we've got a modern expression for it, a description of it, it's called moral injury. There's an article in the Lancet Psychiatry in June 2021 that helps us understand this concept of moral injury. It says, moral injury is understood to be the strong cognitive and emotional response that can occur following events that violate a person's moral or ethical code. When you've got a position, a moral, ethical, spiritual position in life, and yet events occur that make you violate it, it's a damaging experience. It can lead to a range of psychiatric disorders and illnesses, and it's something that these days we're urged to take very seriously for that reason. It concerns stuff we've had no real choice about doing that violates our faith, ethics, belief system, or whatever, and it can be seriously injurious to the person. Just imagine how Esther would have thought about herself for all that she'd been passively pushed into by her situation. And yet, it was that situation that the God of all grace used and transformed to deliver his people. And the fact we serve a dynamic, gracious, and omnipotent God who can do that must be a great help to us when we are seeking to serve him from a position of moral injury. Having to act in the best way we can on the limited understanding and knowledge we might have about what he wills, when we have really limited choices. If that raises any issues for you, and we can be of any help, just please get in touch. For the meantime, I hope it helps you to understand something of what we learned from Esther about being in that sort of situation in life.